That's trumpeter Lester Bowie and his Brass Fantasy with In the Still of the Night. It's from his 1999 album, The Odyssey of Funk and Popular Music, Volume 1. Of course, you know that my most favorite instrument here is the tuba. I'm addicted. I'm a tuba girl. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and the deed has been done. Number 45 is installed. That's Donald Trump. He is now officially President of the United States. Mike Pence, officially Vice President of the United States. And I watched it with some very interesting things happening there. You know, I like to watch people's behavior. You know, in a situation like this, you watch what people are doing. Hillary Clinton, of course, along with Bill Clinton, her husband, there were all these ex-presidents there. Bill Clinton, we had George Bush, we had President Carter, and certainly President Obama. And Hillary arrived appearing to make a note of it by dressing in all white. And it was interesting because where the dignitaries sat, including Trump's daughters, who were dressed in white. So it was a kind of an interesting reaction that Hillary Clinton had, thinking, of course, it would be unusual that anybody would wear white. You know, there is such a thing as winter white, but she was, pardon the pun, she was trumped. But the president, the new president, was not especially diplomatic. And I think that was what he intended to convey. He was not there to make nice. He was quite brusque and blunt. And to some degree, a bit, how should I say, just not observing certain protocols. It is your inauguration day. And I noticed that he did not shake some people's hands that I thought, you know, it would not have killed him to just extend a hand and shake hands and acknowledge people. He was pretty short on that. But his speech was no different in tone or in focus from his campaigning speeches. He talked about the abuses of government. He talked about government being not for the people or by the people, but against the people. He says he will be reversing that immediately. He will be depending and expecting Congress. And this was a direct hit at John, I'm blocking on his name now. We played his speech. John Lewis, the congressman from Georgia. He said that he would be dedicated to making sure that people aren't just talk, but there'll be action. That was a direct hit at Lewis. And the Democrats generally, 60 of them did not turn up as a protest against Trump. And, you know, it didn't matter to him, it seemed, because the mall was crammed with people. And I understand, of course, that there were so many protests going on, but they made it impossible for them to be seen or heard. So a battalion of law enforcement of all types apparently corralled the protesters to areas where they would neither be seen nor heard. But of course, we know that tomorrow, an estimated 200,000 to 300,000 women will be staging their protest. And we'll see how it goes. But I thought that Trump was sullen. He did not look even happy. He was not mirthful. He wasn't he didn't convey any warmth at all. He was there to do this piece of business. And I think it is actually a reflection of how nervous he might have been, how apprehensive he might have been, even with such a large ego. I think this kind of put him on the spot, facing these many people assembled and all the pomp and circumstance and whatnot that you would think he would normally enjoy. He didn't seem to relish that part of the ceremony today. He was very much, he looked apprehensive and tense, not smiling at all, and barely talking to people. But it was also very interesting that prayers, God came into the picture quite a bit. And from his speech today, what we learn is that God is Jewish, God is Christian, God is not at all Muslim. It was quite apparent that this was a deliberate decision. You know, you normally would have people saying prayers and so forth to bless the moment and to the future of this administration, in which he called upon the son of Billy Graham. He called upon an African-American minister to say a prayer. He called upon a Jewish rabbi. And that was pretty much it for prayers. So we can tell that the delicacy of the moment would have called for, you know, being inclusive. And that was what he was talking about, being inclusive. He's talked about putting America first. Yeah, the same stuff he's been talking about on the campaign trail. So there is no difference there. But what was particularly noticeable was his frostiness with the other dignitaries who were there. I would consider it even, I would go so far as to say it was kind of rude to not extend a hand of friendship in a genuine way. I mean, these guys can't do you very much harm right there. They're former presidents, and it's part of the ritual of the transference of power that the ceremony, they're there to basically ensure or to shore up the point that power is passing on to someone new. But he was not particularly warm to them. And I thought that that was an unfortunate thing. It was a great moment. And he should have embraced it as such. And he should have acted with the grace and the courtesy of a person occupying the White House, a president of the United States. He didn't act like that at all. So maybe it was just an expression of being nervous in the moment. He allegedly wrote his own speech, and it sounded like it. But he was just not an outgoing, ebullient Donald Trump today, that's for sure. Either way, President 45 is in place and sworn in, and he said he was going to get to work immediately on a number of critical issues. And I guess we should expect something, especially with the appointment of the U.S. Supreme Court justice, the one who could break any tie, as is the case now, 4-4. So that is a priority item. And there are so many other priority items to finish the filling of cabinet positions, to get on with the confirmation process, and then to deal with whatever his agenda is going to be. We'll see what that is, because a lot of it remains undefined at the moment. In the meantime, the flip side of the coin is, where are we in the scheme of things? Because he just reinforced where he is going and what his vision is. It's America first, and you get all the subtleties of meaning, all the various layers of meaning. What does he mean by America? He says that America is all the people, but it didn't seem like that. He could have dispelled a suspicion, again, by being inclusive, especially in the part of the closing prayers. No Muslims allowed. So that was a direct message that he's sticking very close to his script. It ought to be a very exciting beginning to his administration. Well, we've been talking about Donald Trump coming into office, what we're thinking about that, what we're thinking in terms of preparation, how are we situated to deal with this administration. And so we will continue on our track at 888-874-4888. And we're talking first with Ma'at from New York. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, good. Okay. Hotep to the family. I tell you, this is, I think Marcus Garvey said that, well, he did say that when the conditions become such that finally the people will, you know, galvanate and unify and come together and watch each other's back, which is a good part of the problem. I had mostly on mute until he hear his actual speech. And I didn't see the part where I'd like you to elaborate more as I hang up on that. I didn't see, it sounds like he didn't shake the hand of like people like Jimmy Carter and people like that. Is that what
you
were saying?
Yes, there were people that you would think he would make a very special effort because it's the nature of the occasion where ex-presidents would greet each other. And certainly they will extend a hand of friendship to whoever is new coming in, you know. But he didn't, maybe it was because the seating arrangement was that the presidents were one right after the other in a row. And he didn't want to venture deep into the row to shake everybody's hand. But it was the occasion, the kind of occasion that called for this, you know, it's a diplomatic thing.
And
he should have made a strong effort to do that.
I saw them focusing on Obama, and I thought that Michelle would be sitting by him. But was Michelle there, or did they show
yes.
her at all? Oh, okay.
Yes, they sat together.
Okay, yeah, they just met. Well, I just want, one of the things, a point that I want to make, is same old. He seemed very nervous and uptight. Like you say, it is, you would think that he would be gracious enough to show his joy in, you know, this power play, and there was no smile. And even when he was finished and, you know, the theological folks came up, you know, he seemed like his face is in a permanent frown, and he was almost aware of it at one point.
He had a scowl.
Exactly.
I really do believe he was nervous as hell, and he was a bit, stymied in the moment.
And even, Eutrice, even when he was speaking, I don't know if this is true, but I heard somebody who was analyzing the fact that this strange sniffing that you could actually hear in his speech, which was, you know, that was terrible. I heard somebody speculate, you know, he might be into cocaine. I don't know, but there was this strange...
Oh, because of the sniffles?
He has this
problem where he breathes in quite audibly.
Yeah, and it's just something that you wouldn't want to do in any speech, especially an inaugural speech. The main point that I want to make is this, I mean, it's beyond dog whistle. You know, this idea of his bringing up drugs and gangs is just code to let us know at a time when certain opposing forces, like people like Newt Gingrich, admitted that the disparity in sentencing for crack and cocaine, he actually, there's audio where he calls that racist, Rand Paul, and, you know, where it was becoming a bipartisan effort to look at the fact that 5% of the population has 25% of the world's prison population, even beyond China or Russia. And that's not going to happen now. That seems to be clear. And what I think we need to do is we need to gear up and deal with that specifically, because countries like Uruguay recently, Portugal, and before that, Netherlands did a lot in that area of basically putting aside prohibition and decriminalizing this idea. You know, the people definitely going to alter their reality. This has happened throughout the ages, and he's going to use it as a way to go after what population do you think?
Well, let me ask you this. Is there any possibility that as a strategic move that these disaffected communities could use this moment and his overt and covert racism to their advantage in terms of organizing?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying this is a time where we really need to quadruple down on, the work of people like Michelle Alexander. I find the title is somewhat euphemistic when she says the new Jim Crow, because it's really, I don't know if you're familiar with DuVernay's documentary 13th. But that's what it is. It's slavery, and it actually says that in the Constitution, and that very possibly was by design and deliberate, and he's just going to take that to the next level. So I think we have to do a lot of work and insist that this country and what they've done in terms of their brutal gulag system, you know, must be turned around. I think a lot of energy and effort needs to go into that. Again, we got to get back to the F word, and I'm talking about fascism. And in fact, Danny Sheehan would be a good guest, because I heard him with Gary the other week, and he really, Utrice, broke down why.
Oh, I know. I listened to the program.
Yes, and he really, and you know, the time was over at some point, and he could have gone on, but wedding of corporate chieftains to the strong military state. And that's the other thing Trump said, which I don't understand. You know, what do you mean by making America great and number one? And then he mentions the depleted military and then law enforcement. That is not, those are not directions that this country needs to go in right now. So it's
well,
very troubling.
We would understand more about it, because there is something that is being missed about Donald Trump and where he is right now. And he is in a very precarious position, because the establishment doesn't like him. The Republican establishment doesn't like him. The military and the intelligence community absolutely doesn't like him at all. So he has to double down on his loyalties to his constituency. This is a very interesting thing that is being missed here. Donald Trump is not embraced at all by the establishment. So
but
it would be interesting to see how he dances this dance. But thank you for getting us started today. I appreciate your call. We go to Wisconsin next. Habu, you're on the air.
Thank you so very much, and I hope you're doing well.
I am trying. Thank you.
You know, I listened to your description of the speech, and I think you're spot on. But listening to this subsequent conversation with the previous caller, I would have to disagree ever so slightly. Just two points I want to make. One, I was so encouraged that he completely dissed the power structure. Not because we don't need a power structure, but so many things in this world, whether it's outsourcing, whether it's manufacturing, have become flattened, meaning even in education, all these requirements and all are being flattened out. And so is government going in this direction, I believe. This is the very first person to kind of move in that direction. But this notion that you know, power is not passing from one person to another or from one party to another, hit it right on the head. It is time that the people are the central players in this whole government and the power exercise in this country. It is these politicians serve for us, not the other way around. Yet we are made to feel like outsiders, and you dare not even look at us or criticize us. Not that we've come to that stage, but that's the kind of notion. So I was so happy that it was a strongly populist message. Now, you are correct. There were some, he omitted certain groups and also went out of his way to mention, you know, radical Islam. And I'm troubled by it because this radical Islam is an outgrowth of America's intervention there and bifurcating and splitting up societies. That's what has been an outgrowth of. But then, let's keep that aside. He also went out of his way to mention people in inner cities. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think even Bill Clinton could have done that in the way he did. It was very forceful. It was short, just as he is, pithy. But it was very cogent. And I think if I were in inner city Detroit, it might give me kind of a certain amount of hope for how things are going to change. So I would rate him quite high, and that he dispensed with the protocol is a plus to me. We've had enough of this, and there's this ruling class that just kind of overlooks the rest of the people, and in most cases until now, were oblivious to what was happening in the Rust Belt and what have you. And yet they even have the gall to say, what's wrong with America? It's doing great. You know, yes, he was catering to those people who brought him in, but that is a reality.
Yes, it is his constituency, and the first rule for a politician is survival, which is, you know, across the board. Our first rule also should be survival. And he made it clear, and this was one of the things that I thought was, by the way, a bit unfortunate. It was one thing to be forceful when you're talking to your people, but there is this thing that you have to keep in the back of your head. It is an inauguration. You're not campaigning, and you should observe certain courtesies, and you should be aware of what you're there to do, what your speech ought to be. But it is not far off the mark to say that in his speech today, the tone of it and the way he kind of even physically turned his back on the dignitaries, especially, and the political establishment, I read it as an unnecessary sign of aggression and, frankly, bad manners. He should have been far more conscientious. It is a moment of, it's not a war. It's not a moment to declare war. We know you're going to declare war, but it is about talking about your vision for America, not the same old campaign stuff. Because in coming off as if he's running, still running his campaign, he managed to insult Barack Obama. He managed to insult Hillary Clinton and others. It's not that they don't deserve it, but there is a level of conduct one expects of a statesman. And you say things without, you know, coming out like a boxer ready to deck somebody. And I thought that he needed some schooling in that regard. I thought he missed a mark there. But in a sense, I guess people could say this is refreshing that you have somebody who gives not one whit to protocol. And in a way, that's refreshing because he's saying what he has to say. But when you look at it from a different perspective. This is a historical moment, and everybody is trying to kind of be nice and respect the ceremony, because the ceremony isn't the fight that exists between them. That is not the issue at that moment. The issue is accepting the mantle of power and being very gracious and statesmanlike about it. And the next day, you go to fight. You fight all you want. But it was a bit too sharp and a little unmannerly, because in behaving the way he did, he offended people, and you could see it.
I'm happy that he did that. While these politicians love to engage in pomp and circumstances and then feed their faces with foie gras, here we have to do with, people in the hinterland have to do with food stamps, you know. So there's no tears shed for those, for his, for bring out the brass knuckles. And even he didn't do that. But yes, bring it on. It's time. And let me just say this. If this thing, he is a foil in many ways, because as things worsen, then it becomes a different ball game.
Nobody suspects that Donald Trump, between the primaries and now, nobody suspects that he's changing his tune in any way. I'm just saying there's a way. When you are elected and you're operating at that level, the highest level of elective office in the country, it's an inauguration. You don't have to, swing a switchblade all the time. You say what you have to say, but you adopt a different way of delivery. Because when you say, for example, with the presidents, the former presidents present, and you say things that could be interpreted as being condemnatory of them, that's bad manners. That's really not a good thing to do. It's like inviting a guest to your house and then you start berating them in front of the world. This is not a good thing. Right? So he missed the mark on this point.
Let me just say this. Okay, let's say he brought out a switchblade and he gave him a haircut. It wasn't lethal.
Well, like I said, it was not. It does not in any way make him leave his position. It is just that you understand the nature of the event that you are the center of. And you're not campaigning anymore.
I agree with you, but
protocol that you observe when you. This does not mean that you backpedal on what you believe, and he certainly did not. But it was especially hard-edged, and it came across as very uncultured. A person at that level should have also a level of sophistication, so you know how to slice and dice, and people are bleeding all over the place, except it doesn't feel like it. So you don't have to have a sledgehammer, and you don't have to do that all the time. Do your act. It is an appropriate way to behave in a particular situation, and believe me, I'm not a pro-Trump person, but it is an inauguration, and it's about you, but you look sullen. You look actually detached from the moment. You looked almost like you'd rather not be there. You're insulting people. Because the things that he pointed out in his speech are what actually are the sins, he considers, the sins of these previous administrations. You're not being especially enlightening. People know that. People know what why they don't like the Obama administration or the Clinton administration or the Bush administration or the Carter administration. We all know that. We all know who these people are. So it's not that you're bringing an extra light. You're not doing any extra enlightening of the population by being, you know, somewhat rude. So he needs some lessons in how to be a statesperson and to conduct himself appropriately. He missed a mark.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your call. Khalil from South Carolina, you're on the air.
Wow, Eutrice. How you doing?
Okay. How about you?
I'm great. I hope you're having a great day.
Well, you called, and I'm talking to you. I'm having a superb day.
I listen to you quite often. That was a very forceful statement you just made for you. I think that's great. I mean, truth is the truth, and sometimes people's feelings get hurt. And, you know, let me slow down, because it's really sad. Like, we're in this actual position now.
Yeah.
You keep thinking that the fascist person is going to at least act right. You know, people kept saying, give him a chance. And, I was willing to give, not really, but kind of. I just wanted to see what he would do. Okay, only because I know his history and he's old. However, when he started to pick his cabinet, mm-hmm. I was done. Now, see, I think a lot of people, like you had two callers, and they're so different, but great. The first caller I heard, I totally agree with her, and that's the reason I called. And maybe it was the second caller, who was talking about the message of the fascist and how it might be uplifting the people in Detroit. And esoterically, I can get that. It's like you're so desperate, you want something different. But, you know, when you vote, you need to do some homework before you vote for anybody. It's better not to vote and to vote ignorantly, because you got to know the history of the person you're voting for in some way, shape, or form. Okay? I mean, really, you got to do some. I mean, I understand maybe what he meant. So obviously I disagree with him. But your first caller, this is why I called. It was a woman talking about, and you, I think you remarked on it, in a precarious position.
Yes.
If people like you, I really believe that you've been seeing the same thing, maybe. I can just talk for myself, okay? I've been paying attention. And just like you said, I think this fascist person is in a very precarious position, because you can only play footsie with so many people before your foot gets cut off.
Mm-hmm. And this is high-stakes stuff. You know, it's not being discussed out loud, but I think Donald Trump is very much aware that he, at any time, could be assassinated by the intelligence community. They hate him.
How dumb can you be?
Don't forget, he has attacked them. He has embarrassed them. And, this whole idea about Russia and the leaks and all of that stuff, he has come up consistently with, in their eyes, on the wrong side of issues. And that's not tolerated too well, as you can tell from our own history. That doesn't go too well with the intelligence community. So quiet as it's kept, I am sure today that he had, well, you saw that, if you looked at it at all, you saw that long procession, all kinds of people. You don't know who is who, except that they are Secret Service. But you don't know, you know, there were National Guardsmen. There were all kinds of people out there today. And I believe that Donald Trump has been for some time operating with a consciousness that he is a likely target for assassination, and from the most unlikely quarter. He's a guy talking about patriotism and God and America first and all these other things. But there are people who want to kill him.
Well,
so he doesn't have sure political support in Congress, because he's been fighting them. He doesn't get it in the party. he's already castigated the Republican Party.
You, Treece, if this was not real life in our country, this would be such a great novel.
But, you know, do we ever consider that a Donald Trump, a guy who speaks so forcefully, blah, 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 he is constantly, you know, engaged in this idea that he's a marked man and in his own community.
Well, here's the other thing, too. Remember, he's engaging in buffoonery at a high level.
Yes.
Okay. And because he doesn't understand anything about running a big business. Okay, because it requires, the government is a big, it's not a business, but it's a bureaucracy. He doesn't understand bureaucracy. That's my point. I didn't want to get, let me not even start in that area. He doesn't understand bureaucracy. You know, bureaucracy has been given a bad name through the slanted press from some people in the press now for 35 or 40 years. But, you know, when you have a certain amount of population, you want to be a civilized country or entity or whatever, you have to have bureaucracy. Even if you're in a co-op, there is a bureaucracy. You need that. You need the bureaucrats. And a good bureaucrat will go to work every day and do their job and not worry about who's really in charge, you know, regardless of their party, because they have a job to do, because that's what they like to do. They like to do statistics or compile data or whatever. You know, it's their job. Nobody thinks of, you know, normal people don't think about that when they go to work. But you don't fire everyone and break the daggone government.
But do you realize, though, that what has distilled out of his campaign is he has taken the covers off the intelligence community and the military. And that's, in large measure, who has been running the country for a long time. He is not taking orders from them. He is not a person, so far, he is indicating to them, you don't own me. You don't run me. The military industrial complex,
right,
is what he's up against.
This is why it's such a good novel. There's so many.
Well, you know, there's a movie you should check out called, I think, 7 Days in May. It's a phenomenal movie in which some generals plot a takeover of the United States, and they kidnapped the president. And the idea was they were prepared to kill him if he did not agree to run the country according to their plans. So, I mean, this is one of the incredible revelations about this campaign so far. This is why I'm saying this, between Barack Obama and Donald Trump, this is stuff that people should be studying for years.
I have one question.
The curious position, really, about Donald Trump. I mean, we're so clear about his racial problems and all of that, and how uncouth and uncultured he is. We get that. But I'm looking at the deeper issue here, and that is that we are assuming, the public is assuming, well, it's only about that. What we don't see is the huge fight, I think, that is going on with Donald Trump that he can't talk about. But it is clear, it's been, you know, coming out in dribs and drabs in other issues like this issue of Russia hacking and so forth, which was yet another instance in which Trump embarrassed and boldly attacked or counterattacked the intelligence community. They don't like him at all. And it's been a while since you've seen this level of animosity, this open kind of warfare between a president. He was then a president-elect, but it will continue as president. And that is not a good thing. But it's something to watch, because it puts him in a very, very precarious position, because he has a bunch of wars going. And that is why the more intense it becomes, the more he looks to his base of support. that behavior that we saw today spoke volumes. As I said, I observe not necessarily what people do. I look at what they don't do. It's not about what they say. It's what they don't say. For example, the rabbi was very clearly Zionistic. And he talked about, he actually said so in his prayer for Zion and Jerusalem. Now, if you pair that with the stark absence of any Muslim offering a prayer for the nation, you see where that's going. Nobody was supposed to get into politics, but the rabbi managed to couple Zion, a Zionist desire for protection of the Lord, you know, of Zion and Jerusalem in a prayer. Now, you pay attention to these little things and you see where things are going. But mark my word, this is a major challenge for Donald Trump. His adversarial relationship with the intelligence community, and they want him out of the way, and he knows that. He knows that. Thanks so much for calling, Khalil. Great to hear from you today. Chris from Lawrence, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, Trace.
Hey, what's up?
Happy New Year to all the PRN listeners and staff.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it, and same to you. Let's hope it's a good and productive year for you.
Oh, it will be. If I can learn something once a day, you know, we'll see how it plays out. But real quick, I was at the Small Business Development Center this morning at York College, right? Because I try to get something done on Fridays, which are my day off. And I tell you, trying to free yourself from your employer is just, it may be harder today than it was 20 years ago. The average business in my area, let's say gas station, supermarket, things that people use on a day-to-day basis that provide wealth for families for generations, on average, those things cost you roughly $1 million. You know, just to open. And based on the loan structures, you would need $150,000 cash just to qualify for the other $850,000. And so if we're going to empower ourselves and survive through these moments, I would say that we definitely need to focus on building these things for ourselves and pulling our cash when we can in order to provide these things. Because we could be mad at Donald Trump all day, but if his friends over at Exxon, you know, if we continue to buy their fuel every single day nonstop without a break for a second a day, they'll stay as rich and powerful as they've always been until the day we all die. And they'll just pass it on to their grandchildren and trusts. So, you know, we do need to remove these people politically if we can, but we should also be planning, in my opinion, some sort of financial opposition, even if it's industries we don't particularly want to be a part of for moral reasons. That doesn't mean we should leave it to our oppressors.
Well, I agree with that, but I always point to the fact that we seem averse to making plans. I don't know why. We hate the idea of planning. And planning involves studying. You've got to study. It sounds like a good idea to say, well, we ought to do so and so and so, but do you understand the system? Do you understand what it would take? How it works? These are the things that we have to do. We have to undertake studies, not to be paralyzed by studies to the point where you get nothing done. You fully invested in just studying.
You become overwhelmed. No,
exactly.
The study should be to empower you, not to impale you.
Exactly. But we don't understand, and I go back to my favorite coinage of systems. You got to have a system. And your system has to take into consideration the overall system. If you're going to succeed, what is this system? And in understanding the overarching system, what system can you devise that would reasonably give you some success, that you could reasonably predict will be successful? And we usually start at the wrong end of the stick. We start at the results. We want the results, but we don't understand systems. Most of the businesses that would start up will fail.
Yes.
Simply because they don't understand systems. They confuse ideas. They have an idea to do something, but they don't put it to the test, and they don't check it out.
Then you have to know about the property taxes and when they're going to change and what it's based on, and maintaining property and licensing. It's not pretty and fun work, much like I would imagine organizing for any serious political movement. It's slow, and it's sometimes you get 0.5% of what you need to get done, and that takes a week, but that's the process, and I think that's where we have to get close to. The work that is slow and tedious and costly in time and in money, I think we have to take a real approach to it, because from what I'm seeing in these so-called grassroots movements, you know, I don't think that these are just poor people walking around screaming. I would imagine that they're getting money from their billionaire celebrities, be it the Koch brothers or these folks over at Exxon who spend money confusing and misleading people. These so-called grassroots movements, these people are getting paid. But I don't see the same on our side. I don't see us demanding it or asking for it or planning for it.
I still say there are enough, more than enough business models available, already put on paper, that have already been put to the test and proven to be successful. There are more than enough. We just have to go and read them and adapt them to today. Some things have to be updated, but there are many different business models out there crafted by people who paid sometimes with their lives, in our experience, for having that kind of vision. There are people who have been tremendously successful, and their business models are perfectly applicable today. But do we bother to pick up a book and say, okay, Madam C.J. Walker was a multimillionaire, and her whole thing was hairdressing. Okay, what was her model? Why not take a look at that? What was Marcus Garvey's model?
I know you mentioned Mark. Yes, I know you mentioned Marcus Garvey also.
Yeah. You have all kinds of business models that you can study, and you can see how they might apply to you, what you want to do. Not the same exact business, but...
No, but the model itself, the system itself that they devised.
Exactly. It's time saving. It's already there.
Yeah.
You can see what they did, how they succeeded, and what was the model that they developed out of their direct experience, and highly successful.
And I will bring that into my studies. And can I just mention, as far as Trump is concerned, I have to disagree with you. I kind of agree with his treatment of the establishment. They might kill him. And I'm not wishing death on anyone. But what I would like to see is more people willing to stand up for what they believe in at the risk of that very same death. Because as far as I'm concerned, the danger that he has put himself in takes his courage and maybe his stupidity past anyone that I've encountered in my life.
Right. All I'm saying is appreciate this dimension of his particular situation. It's not part of the equation right now. It's not being discussed at all. But this is very much a major factor in Trump's political orientation. He has been so brazen and, or as you see, is not so bright in the way he has approached his politics. That
no, he hasn't been, but he has been. But he has been successful.
Well, yes, but I'm saying we just need to keep in mind that he's in a pickle.
Well, that's fun for me. I'm enjoying it.
My thing is, but don't discount the fact that, you know, people think that he's got it going on. And the answer may be quite different. He does not have it going on because he's now beginning to understand what he's dealing with.
You know how a five-year-old thinks when they were grown up, they're going to do whatever they want? And then you become a grown-up and you realize, I got to get to bed on time because I got to work tomorrow. And, you know, I got to pay these bills. And, like, he's having a grown-up moment. Right now, he's just – we're all looking at him like he's the president. I think he's just realized he's not in charge.
Exactly.
And that might be what he's reflecting on right now. And that sucks when you spend your entire life being spoiled.
So how do you retreat if you were a Trump? How do you retreat from this persona that you have created, that you're brash, you're ready, you're going to take everybody on, and you did that from a point of ignorance? You had no clue about this web of craziness that you were going to be ensnared by.
I would hate to advise him because, you know, I assume they're always listening when we're talking. But the best way, if he wanted to be president again and he wanted to win, like, already, outside of giving us all free Wi-Fi or cable, what he could say is, listen, I thought I was going to be the biggest boss in the world and I was going to tell everybody what to do, but I realized that I had to listen to the American people. All he has to say is I had to learn to trust the dedicated FBI and CIA agents. I had to learn to trust the IRS. I had to engage and advise and then trust that they were doing the right thing based on our cooperative, you know, he could easily surrender to the bureaucracy, to the republic. He could surrender and say he's doing it in the best interest of America. He realized the president is not a boss; he is a servant of the people. And if he did that and got GM and Ford to put jobs back in America, he would win the next 4 years. He would win 8 years easily. I don't know that that's what's going to happen. I'm just saying that would be an easy retreat. I thought I was going to come in and be a king, and I realized I was a servant.
I'm observing from the sidelines how he deals with this. Again, it's not being covered, but it's so clear that it needs to be, because this is a formidable problem. And you have the, as they call it, the deep state, that is accustomed to running things and running presidents and telling them what to do. And it has failed. It failed against with Hillary Clinton because Trump succeeded in putting them on the spot with respect to Hillary Clinton.
And you can't call a mafia friend to bail you out of this one because, you know, our government's been known to pay them to kill people like him. So he really doesn't, in reality, have anyone to turn to.
That's my point.
And he might just be realizing that. And it's good. It's a sobering moment for him to have, like I would hope at some point most adults have. If he took all the credit cards away from people and all these high-interest loans, if he took them all away and people had to deal with reality for a couple of minutes, it'd be good for all of us.
Well, let's see. Let's see how that goes. Thanks so much.
I'm not saying that's going to happen. We're just telling jokes to each other here. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you so much for your call. I enjoyed talking with you. Now, that brings us to the end of our program today, but not the end of our discussion. We can continue this next week. Other than with the Free Your Mind Friday slot, we can also accommodate calls that we weren't able to take today. We'll do that next week. A lot of stuff coming your way next week that has been developing and being worked on, and it concerns the Clintons. Major, major developments there. So we'll be discussing them next week. And we'll continue this discussion about our developing consciousness about the political system that we have to deal with, and what are we doing to prepare ourselves for what looks to be a protracted fight. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned. Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. You always will learn something new from him. And I want to introduce you to an idea about how you can listen to this program, and you would want to pass this on, I hope. To listen live by phone, I'm going to give you a number, 712-775-6850, to listen live by phone, so you could pass this on to people who may not have access to any other means but by phone, so that's possible. And if you want to get the last five shows, you can call 1-701-719-9977. I'll be announcing these numbers quite frequently, and it's a way of growing this audience, and I'm asking you to help in that task to grow the audience and to grow PRN's influence in this political morass that we are living in. So the numbers again, to listen by phone, 712-775-6850, and to listen to the last five shows, 701-719-9977. Have yourselves a great weekend. Surround yourselves with people who are positive and add positive dimension to your lives. And we'll see each other on Monday. Thanks.